Exactly. So the first detection of gravitational waves have supported now many considerations what those stars which ended their life in this event, how they spent their lifetime. And I will now start from the opposite end. We are in our group in Potsdam together with Lydia and some others. We are dealing with the massive stars in their blooming life, and then we can discuss what happens with them when they die, finally. So starting with the blooming life of massive stars, just to introduce the abbreviations, this is an HR diagram. Actually, it is the upper left corner of an HR diagram. The sun would be way down to the basement. The two dashed lines, this is the zero H main sequence, where a star would start its life if it would be completely homogeneous, solar composition and central hydrogen burning. This is a theoretical line called helium zero H main sequence. This is where a helium star, homogeneous helium star, would sit in this diagram. And just as a sketch of what could happen along the evolution, a star would start, of course, from zero H main sequence, might eventually pass through some instability here, which we'll discuss later. The luminous blue variable is not indicated here, might have an excursion to the red side of the HR diagram, so could show up as a red supergiant. Also, I forgot to say, in the early time of its life, it's called an O-type star or a B-type star, or both together an OB-type star. So then going to the red supergiant, maybe it would eventually return to the blue side of the HR diagram, and at that moment would show a completely different type of spectra, emission line spectra, which have been discovered 150 years ago by Wolf and Rayet. Therefore, they're called Wolf-Rayet stars. And finally, such a star might end his life in or must end his life in a core collapse, which could give rise to a supernova explosion, gamma ray burst, or might be just a silent collapse to a black hole. So now we are looking a bit more closely, first in our galaxy. The Wolf-Rayet stars, I will start with, Wolf-Rayet stars are rare objects, so they are order of 1,000 in our galaxy. We have studied most of them, and this is now then it turns out that this class is not so simple. There are different flavors of Wolf-Rayet stars, which are here shown in different color codings. There's one group of Wolf-Rayet stars which is very luminous, more than 10 to the 6 solar luminosities, and those stars are a bit cooler, and they are characterized by nitrogen, strong nitrogen emission lines in their spectra, therefore are called the WN stars. And this WN sequence is subdivided with the numbers, and the later ones are called WN late. And these very luminous WN stars, they're all typically of the WN8 flavor. And these WNL stars, they're actually not what you expect as a Wolf-Rayet star. They are not yet helium stars. They contain hydrogen in their surface between 20 and 55, or other way around, 55 and 20%. That means hydrogen is depleted, helium is enriched, but helium, hydrogen is still there, and most likely these stars are still in a hydrogen-burning phase. The proper WR stars are actually the WN early, the hotter ones, but they come typically at slightly lower luminosities. They are completely void of hydrogen. That means they are really helium stars. Only nitrogen is slightly enriched. That means we see material in the surface which has undergone CNO burning. Then there is another big group of Wolf-Rayet-Stasz, which I call the WC sequence, where C standing for the carbon lines, which are dominating their spectra. These are now chemically really a different thing, because they show material which is highly enriched in carbon, also in oxygen. Helium is depleted, hydrogen, of course, completely gone. That means here we see at the surface material which has undergone helium burning by triple alpha process. And one can even separate a little subclass of those which are called the WO stars, where the oxygen is very strong. That means they are in even an advanced stage of helium burning. So these are the galactic zoo. And now what we are going to do now is try to figure out how these are evolutionarily connected. So I will introduce this type of diagram here. Now we draw into the same HR diagram evolutionary tracks. Yeah, these are these lines. So for instance here, a star, these lines, the evolutionary tracks are labeled by their initial mass, which the star has on the zero H main sequence. Later, of course, the mass might be much lower. So say a 20 solar mass star starts, the thin black line is a pre-WR stage, that means O or B stars, O stars here, yeah? And at some point, the track is color-coded according to the surface abundance, which is predicted by the evolutionary track. Yeah, with the same color coding which I use it for the analyzed stars here, and red means hydrogen is still visible, green means hydrogen free, blue means advanced composition from helium burning. So you see here, for instance, these tracks at higher mass, they go, come back, become first WN late, WN early, finally WC. But of course, what you also see that these tracks here, which I picked here up, is actually the what they think most advanced tracks from the Geneva group, but unfortunately they don't match the observation. So since they don't match the observation, so we must make some empirical kind of scenario. And this is so tentative scenario which we think which would fit the observation, that we have to distinguish certain mass ranges of the initial mass. Stars below 20 solar masses might really go to the red supergiant stage, might return to the blue side or not, and then explode as a supernova which still has hydrogen in there, therefore supernova type 2. Where in the intermediate mass range between 20 and 40, say, solar masses, the evolution might proceed further. So when the star returns from the red supergiant, from the red side of the HR diagram, it finally becomes a WN star, later a WC star, and finally explodes as a hydrogen deficient supernova, which would mean type 1b, 1c, if it doesn't collapse silently. And if a star is even more massive than 40, then the red supergiant stage, I will comment on that a bit later, the red supergiant stage seems not to happen. So the star stays always, it is life on the left side of the HR diagram, might undergo LBV, luminous blue variable eruptions, might then become a hydrogen-free, W an early type star, WO star maybe, and if it doesn't collapse silently, might form a gamma ray burst or a supernova 2N, this N with the narrow hydrogen emission lines, because there is still material, might be still material around from the LBV phase. Yeah?
Well, I was just going to ask, you mentioned that the tracks don't match the observations. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because you have tracks going.
Yeah. I will expand on that a little bit later. Yeah, what is the problem with the tracks? Yeah, might be. Yeah. The hydrogen would be from the LBV eruption around. That was at least suggested that this is. some narrow hydrogen emission lines from the surrounding material. Okay, I don't know. Or the collapse might be silent. What?
What about selection effects?
Sam?
Selection effects in finding distances. When you look at the number density of points in that diagram, so those are
the selection effects, yeah. In our galaxy, R stars are easy to spot if they are not obscured in the optical. When new galactic WR stars are discovered, they are all discovered in the infrared, because in the infrared we have not yet the sensitivity to overlook the whole galaxy. Maybe some parts will never be seen because they are too much obscured. Yeah? But those which are not obscured, that is basically all of them. But here, for this diagram, I have selected only those which are apparently single. I will talk about binaries later. Yeah.
So that,
that gap seems to be real. Seems to be real. Yeah, I only want to draw the attention to this latest stage, the WO stars. There are four in our galaxy, as far as we know. Two of them are shown here, are analyzed. These are stars which are really close to the endpoint of their evolution. These two here, they have an effective temperature of 200,000 Kelvin. They are very compact, smaller than our sun luminosity, you see. And now the question is, what is their mass? The mass is very hard to figure out, because they don't have absorption lines. We cannot measure the gravity or so. So we can only estimate the mass from some mass-luminosity relation. And depending which relation you take, here, for instance, I give 19 and 20. If I take this track literally, the endpoint of this track would be, 12.3. Yeah, so there is some room. What is the remaining mass? It again depends on the mass loss along of these tracks. This is really the crucial thing, the mass loss. Interesting aspect here is that these two seem to have a very high rotation, also difficult to measure because of the wind broadening of the line, but they seem to rotate with more than 1,000 kilometers per second. Therefore, Stan Woosley would say they are probably going to make a gamma ray burst when they collapse in the next 100,000 years or so. What? Now, yeah, from the line profile, but it is difficult, because the rotation. So, what happens with the stellar wind when the star rotates? Let's assume conservation of angular momentum. Then the rotation goes down when a volume element is going to higher radius. Well, of course, one can all model that. We are doing that and try to distinguish. The shape is slightly characteristic from wind broadening. Yeah?
Is it still consistent with this model here? And that this is all just broadening by the wind? Or does it 1,000 kilometers per second mean it's at least faster than a certain value?
Now, the wind in this WO stars is 5,000 kilometers per second. Yeah? So the wind broadening makes a big line profile. But now when you model, or when we model this effect of rotation with conservation of angular momentum and so, then it gives a slightly different shape. And it greatly helps when we assume that there are magnetic fields which makes inner part of the wind co-rotate. Then it gives, of course, even more wind broadening, but it is an unknown parameter. So therefore I wrote approximately 1,000. I would not bet exactly on the value. But it is clear that there are other stars, which Wolf-Rayet stars, which do not rotate and which have a characteristically different line profile. So something is going on there with rotation. Also, I would not bet on the precise value. So I made the point already that mass loss is crucial. Yeah. So what are actually the mass loss rates? So let's start again with the Wolf-Rayet stars. So it's not just one rate, yeah? For O stars, yeah, there are distributions. The O stars tend to rotate with a few hundred. What? Sorry?
From a day to 100 days.
So with a few hundred kilometers per second, but now this WO stars, they have already contracted a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. What? No? Of course.
If they contract,
now yeah, but of course they contract, I mean. Obviously, the radius shrinks from 15 solar radius. Yeah, the question is how much angular momentum is going away with the mass loss and how much is ingested inside. Yeah, the question is the hydrogen all going away, or is it ingested inward and burned? So that the angular momentum evolution is also part of course, what Rex might predict, but there are too many unknowns in it. Yeah? So let me continue about the mass loss rates. So mass loss rate is not just one value. It is, of course, a function of various parameters. So we're still staying with galactic metallicity. So the main parameter for the mass loss rate is the luminosity of the star. So O stars tend to follow roughly this line. The hydrogen containing WN stars have higher mass loss rates. A tentative fit would be the red line, and the hydrogen free even higher. So the evolutionary stage also matters for the mass loss rate. So I put here a factor of 5 basically between those three classes of stars. So now comes the next question, of course, especially regarding the gamma ray burst and also the gravitational waves events. So how does this mass loss rate depend on metallicity? So we have not so much possibilities to study it. We can only look at nearby galaxies where we can resolve the stellar populations so that the best cases, studied cases, are the small Magellanic Cloud with 1/5 or so of solar metallicity, the large Magellanic Cloud slightly lower than solar, the Milky Way, and the Andromeda galaxy with similar metallicity. And all these empirical studies, we developed a formula so where the mass loss rate is fitted as a function of luminosity, stellar temperature, the evolutionary stage, which is represented by the helium abundance, helium mass fraction, and the metallicity for the rest of the metals. Yeah, yeah, it's not the same star. Look, this formula has more parameters. This here shows only the luminosity. Yeah? There's also the effect temperature, and maybe that's not all of parameters. Maybe there are still, so there is, even with such a fit, there is still a significant scatter, and one can ask the question, what are possible further parameters, like the initial angular momentum also. Yes. I will show how we measure the mass loss, right? Yeah. Yeah. This formula is an average over all data which we have, so to say. Yeah. It's a fit. In the galaxy 150 or so, and the LMC of order of what also LMC also 100, I think. Yeah. No, I think even 100. And the SMC, there are not so many Wolf Rayet stars, 7 or 8 or so. And the Andromeda is not yet fully analyzed. So far dozens. Yeah?
Same. I will
also comment on that, yeah, for a second. The error bars are the statistical errors from the whole sample of stars which goes into this.
Okay, so it's not, they're not driven by individual mass loss measurements, they're
No, the individual are much much more precise. It's a statistical error from the average.
The way I understood your problem the previous time is you fit the L T star in your fraction and it was to be marginalized with all the other parameters and you're finally showing M dot as a function of C. Am I right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's also the question is also what is actually Z? It is the pattern now also slightly different between the. Yeah, so now the same business. Okay, then I will make it a bit short now about O stars. So the same business has been done for O stars. This is basically on the y-axis. Also the mass loss rate, which so the modified wind momentum basically scales with the mass loss rate. It's a quotation from Mokiem et al. 2007, and the different metallicities here are indicated, and there is the metallicity dependence established, and is with the power 0.8. Yeah. Now going back shortly, you saw here. We find that the metallicity dependence for Fourier stars is pretty steep, yeah, more than linear, with power 1.2 or so, and for O stars the metallicity dependence is less strong. Yeah, this one. Yeah, each of the stripes from the Mokiem paper, each of the stripes is a different metallicity. I think the shaded zone gives the error.
So when you write down that equation and dot the proportion of that of R 0.83.
And other factors. Yeah. Okay. And luminosity and so. So only. No. This gives only one factor in the fit formula. This is a Z-dependent formula. There's also a luminosity dependence. There's also a.
It is the offset
between the three. Yeah. Okay. So measuring mass loss rates. So I first start with the difficulties. So the question, what are the true mass loss rates, is highly debated since many years, because it turned out that mass loss measurements depend on details of the physics, especially on the inhomogeneities in the stellar wind. Yeah, this runs under the term clumping, and if we look more closely, then we distinguish between microclumping and macroclumping. Microclumping means that the individual structures are optically thin. That makes life relatively simple because the radiation field doesn't feel this little inhomogeneities, makes the treatment quite possible consistently. Macroclumping is more difficult, and the bad news is that microclumping tends to reduce the empirical mass loss rate, which we derive from fitting stellar spectra. Macro clumping goes in the opposite direction, so we have two effects which mess up our results. But of course, we try to do our best and to estimate empirical mass loss rates from spectral analyzers by using quite non-trivial model calculations, model atmospheres, non-LTE simulations, which account for thousands of lines. Actually, with iron lines, it is rather 10 million of iron lines, and all these different cross-sections, oscillator strengths, and so on, to get the whole structure of the stellar wind, temperature stratification, and so on. The only thing which we do not do by standard is the mass loss rate is not consistently put in, but kept as a free parameter that we can compare and measure it by comparison. Yeah, and this is, so to say, that how the daily business is looking like. Well, Fourier spectrum, as I said, is an emission line spectrum, and so blue would be the observation, red would be a model prediction from our Potsdam Wolf-Rayet model atmospheres, and when those two fit, then we would say we have got the right mass loss rate by this procedure, and of course we can also measure the fit the individual lines from the different species and get abundances and so on, and of course soil temperature. So okay, when it's so difficult to measure the mass loss rate empirically, what to why not predict them theoretically? So there is a theory about stellar winds, line-driven stellar winds, and I want to make the point that mass loss by line-driven winds is unavoidable. So it must be there. This is a very efficient process. Yeah. So imagine this would be the flux distribution schematically for a star. And imagine you have a spectral line sitting here, and imagine this line is optically thick. Then this line would absorb all momentum which is at this wavelength. Then the wind would start to move. That means the line will see a Doppler-shifted radiation field. And then it sees again the unabsorbed radiation which is coming from the stellar surface, so to say, or from the stellar photosphere. Will be accelerated and so on. And by this, the line sweeps up the, over a whole wavelength span according to the Doppler shift, sweeps up the momentum from a whole wavelength span. Yeah? And if you put this Doppler formula together, it turns out that one single optically thick line removes or sports a mass loss rate which has the same number as the mass which is converted into energy by nuclear burning of the star. Yeah, it's by accident exactly the same rate. Okay, when so a nuclear burning is not 100% effective, but so hydrogen by less than 1%. So the nuclear fuel which is consumed is 100 times more than that, but there is also more than one line, so we may also have 100 lines in a star, and that shows that now we have two processes which make a star aging: the nuclear burning and the removal of mass by the stellar wind. Both are of the same order of magnitude. And that's the reason why these evolutionary tracks are so sensitive, because it's a balance between two processes of the same order of magnitude, mass loss and nuclear burning. Yeah? There are theoretical predictions now on basis of this Castor, Abbott, and Klein theory. They also predict a metallicity dependence, but this theory is not yet really in an elaborated stage. Yeah? It makes statistical assumptions and so on. There are also other ways of predicting theoretical mass loss rate by Fink et al., most well known. It predicts the mass loss dependence with the power z to power 0.7, but also this is not a fully consistent theoretical description of mass loss rates. We are working on this. It's really necessary to get this better, but there are hard problems which are not easy to overcome. So to make it in short, so what we would need is a hydrodynamic modeling together with the full non-LTE radiative transfer. And most sensitive for the mass loss rate is a critical point, yeah, where the flow goes from subsonic to supersonic regime and no information can travel back. And at the critical point, we would need to know the exact physical conditions. And especially, it would be sensitive to the microturbulence. Yeah, no one knows what is the microturbulence at the critical point. Okay, I have to hurry up a bit, but I was interrupted, so maybe part of the discussion was already.
Can you comment a little bit on the variability of the lines?
Yeah, variability of the lines is a second-order effect in general. Yeah. Difficult statement. In Wolf-Weiss, that's a second-order effect. In O-stars, the variability is pretty pronounced. Yeah, there is variability, which also shows the wind inhomogeneities, right?
But I mean, can you infer some filling factor?
Yeah, in principle, yeah.
And do you see any changes with luminosity or with variability?
This is not yet studied. Yeah, the variability timescale is pretty short, so it's challenging. Yeah, we have basically amateurs who are doing these observations because you need long time. Yeah, time series over whole night or so. For what?
Is clumping as much of an uncertainty for Wolf-Rayet, for Maslow's rate as for O-stars?
It is as bad for O-stars as for Wolf-Rayet stars, yeah. Maybe even worse for O-stars. Yeah? Okay, so to wrap up this part of the talk, so the people would now like to know what they should use for their, say, stellar evolution calculations or population synthesis or so. For Wolf-Rayet stars, of course, I would praise our own fit formula. For OB stars, one might apply the Fink Maslow's rates, but probably they must be reduced by some factor, maybe 0.3, maybe not so drastically. For OB stars, which are not supergiants, but on the main sequence or lower luminosity classes, the situation is completely unclear. There's something which is called the weak wind problem. It might be resolved by the fact that most of the wind might be in the hot phase, shocked phase, which we don't see then in the optical, only in the X-rays. But fortunately, in this stage, the Maslow's rate is not so important yet. LBV eruptions, the situation is highly debated. An LBV eruption can eject a couple of solar masses when the star goes super Eddington, yeah, as it was published recently by Elliot. But it is debated whether all massive stars actually go through an LBV phase or if it is only something for special beasts. Red supergiants, mass loss in the red supergiant phase is also a debated thing, is also important, but it's only important for those stars which actually go to the red supergiant phase. That means it might not be important for the most massive ones. So now I'm already running a bit out of time, so I will now quickly go to stellar evolution at low metallicity. So far I was talking about galactic metallicity. So at low metallicity, we are looking at the large Magellan, at the small Magellanic Cloud. Yeah, these are all WN stars in the large Magellanic Cloud. So what is the surprise? They're all sitting left of the hydrogen main sequence. And when we look at their chemical composition, they are not genuine helium stars. They all have a lot of hydrogen in their envelope, therefore this color is reddish here. Yeah? So they are not explained by any of those tracks which go to the right and back and so on. Yeah? So they are, okay, we can then go to different authors. You can take any different evolutionary tracks, they're all highly different. This is now, what is this? This is Geneva. Quote the newer version from 2013. They're completely off from the observation. Another set of tracks completely off from the observation. Ah, whoop, this could do it. Homogeneous evolution, yeah, from Broad et al. The homogeneous evolution means a star always contracts right away from the hydrogen main sequence up to the helium main sequence, yeah, to the upper left. And this is where we find all the stars. The surface abundances are not exactly in agreement, but at least roughly.
So the previous scenarios we tested, they have mass loss built into them?
Yeah, mass loss is in, but with different recipes, whatever they assume. So there are three major issues with this evolutionary calculation. The mass loss in the different phases, the convective core overshoot, and the rotational mixing. Yeah. As it all plays over.
So what worries me a lot, what we did is the temperatures on the stellar surface, because now the temperatures of the photosphere agreements, right? So I'm not sure what is the temperatures of the low relations that are flowing there. I think an atmosphere is missing between the stellar tracks.
Yeah, that is an issue one must carefully discuss, especially when the winds are very, very strong and very thick, which is not the case here. Here we must find an agreement at which optical depths we put our reference radius where we quote the stellar temperature. And for such a thin wind, it doesn't matter, is it at optical the Tau Rosalind 10 or 20 or 100. What? Low metallicity. The winds are anyhow weaker in the small.
Oh,
sorry?
So you're saying that this
What means optical thin at which wavelengths? What? We model the entire spectrum, of course. Anyhow.
What's the massless
rate? I can give you numbers somewhere. Sorry, I don't.
10 to minus 7
massless? Yeah, 10 to minus 6 rather. Yeah, 10 to minus 6, 10 to minus 7. I forgot. One can look it up in the Heinisch et al. Paper. I think I didn't give. Yeah. It is a temperature issue is discussed there. Yeah. I mean, that's the only type of tracks which match. All other inhomogeneous tracks would go to the right of the hydrogen main sequence. Only the more or less homogeneous tracks staying to the left.
Is there anything we should read that the number density of points is almost equal with the mass increase? I mean, what are the selection effects?
Yeah. Of course, one should actually also compare synthetic populations to see the evolutionary speed along the tracks, which is also not very conclusive when you have only 7 measured points. But unfortunately, the small Magellanic cloud doesn't provide us more.
It seems like you have equal number of 60 and 40 and 20.
Yeah. Okay, but this, in any case, a small number statistics, yeah? So we are happy. We can also put in the diagram red supergiants. It's consistent that there are no red supergiants more bright than 5.8 log L. Yeah, there are a handful of very massive, very luminous blue stars. This is one example here, which we analyzed. They are also not to the right of the main sequence. So our preliminary conclusion is the most massive stars prefer homogeneous evolution at low metallicity, like the Small Magellanic Cloud. They are slow rotators, as far as I know. V-sin-I, yeah, but with wind broadening and so. In the Heinisch paper, there are V-sin-I measurements given with error bars. Yeah.
So why is it, for the galactic stars, we would expect them to go through a luminous blue variable phase and perhaps use plenty of mass and just go bluewards instead of going to become red giants. So why can't you have the same thing here for most massive ones?
Yeah, so luminous blue variables. So I'm running out of time, so I can only shortly go to the rest of the talk. Yeah. So massive stars and binaries is now the question. There are luminous blue variables in the SMC. Yeah, most famous the star AB5 in this naming here, which is which we call Gloria's star, yeah, this WN plus WN plus and so on, yeah, trapezium system. So we have also analyzed those, and it is a bit amazing that these stars, they're actually consistent with the classical evolutionary scenario, with Rochlob overflow, the stashed parts of the tracks, yeah. Binary evolution models have been produced by J.J. Eldridge for this figure here. And now it's a bit counterintuitive. The binary stars don't go the homogeneous channel, the single star don't. Our hand-waving explanation is, these are all white binaries. Those are parameters here. Pretty massive things. This is all five of them which exist, yeah. Pretty massive things, and the hand-waving explanation is that they are white binaries, and this would actually lead to a breaking of the rotation tidally. Yeah. So then that was massive binaries. Now a short slide on massive stars in binaries with a compact companion. As you know, there are two kinds of, there's a high mass X, so they are all high mass, they are detected as high mass X-ray binaries because the accretion on the compact companion produces a lot of energy, which is seen in the X-ray band. And one can distinguish a different type of donor stars. If the donor star is a blue supergiant or B or WR stars, then they are here in the Corbett diagram, the P dots, so they not P dots, sorry, the pulse period of the neutron star versus the orbital period of the system. In this corner, we find the WinFET system. Then there are a lot of stars which are fed by a BE companion. When the neutron star is passing through the decretion disk of the BE star, it takes up matter. And the third group is fed by a Roche-Lobb overflow. And among the compact companions, one can distinguish the neutron star system, which is the vast majority, and a few black hole systems where the mass seems to indicate that the compact companion is a black hole. There's in our galaxy Cygnus X3, there's this IC10 X1 or NGC 300 X1, where pretty high black hole masses have been found by some authors and have been debated by other authors because it's difficult to measure a radial velocity curve from this huge wide emission lines of the WR spectrum. And if one admits that the compact companion with its high X-ray radiation disturbs the spherical symmetry of the wind from the massive star, then you can get an artificial effect on the line center or on the radial velocity curves, which might lead to spurious mass estimates. Yeah, and the second type of compact companions, massive stars and compact companions, would be the ULXs, which are by definition those which have more than 10 to 39. I'm finishing now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So they seem to be, or the luminosity function looks similar, or like an extrapolation extension of the luminosity function of normal high mass X-ray binaries. So maybe it's the same type of stars. Amazingly, they all show Wolf-Rayet type spectra, which we don't understand yet. So this is my summary. Which you may read, it's given the same points. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have a small amount of time for questions.
I was wondering if there is any line of evidence for the presence of magnetic fields in the wind of Wolf-Rayet stars.
Directly, none. So we have looked very carefully. It's difficult because of the broad lines. We have one example where we have, 2.5 sigma or so, or 3 sigma tentative detection of the Zeeman effect in a WR star, which is called WR6, which we observed very long with polarimetry. But there's also an excuse. What if the star have magnetic fields which are not organized on a big scale like a huge dipole, but which are organized in a small scale, which would cancel out in any Zeeman traditional Zeeman effect measurements? Then we would miss it also what is there. And we have some indications, as I said, with this rotational broadening, we have some indications that sometimes might be that the lower part of the wind is co-rotating with the star. That could only be explained if there would be quite strong magnetic fields. But since we miss them to see in polarimetry, there must be small-scale magnetic fields, which I could also understand because the convection zone, which is actually present in the atmosphere, is not very deep. It's a shallow could be.
So just to clarify this last point about ULXs, the optical spectra, is this believed to be the optical spectrum of the accretion disk?
Yeah, that is exactly the debate. I think I wrote the remark on it, yeah. Some people think that It is the spectrum of the donor star. It's amazing. We just took such spectra, fits them with the WN model, and it fits perfectly. The spectra are not very good, of course. It's very faint targets. It fits perfectly. That makes you scratch.
Even the velocities?
Yeah.
Okay.
Looks like highs are high, yeah, but it looks quite perfect. Other people think that here, Sergei Fabrika thinks that it's a disk wind. And I mean, we're working on the subject, but it is not finally settled. I cannot imagine that the disk wind would look exactly like a stellar spectrum, but yeah.
Can you comment a little bit on the X-ray emission of individual Wolf-Rayet stars? I mean, we know that they're relatively bright in X-rays. Do you see a correlation with the luminosity?
They're actually not so bright in X-rays compared with O stars. They are fainter. For instance, WC stars are hardly any or none. WO stars, she once found one with. But the problem is, the stellar wind is basically optically sick to X-rays. So it is rather a correlation with the wind absorption than with the intrinsic emission of X-rays. So what we so far believe, but we have increasing doubts on it, is the scenario that since the radiative driving, this wind driving is an unstable process, that there are shocks created, they make X-rays, and then it's a question how much is absorbed and how much can escape from the star, which also depends again on the clumping, yeah, on the effective opacity of the clumped wind and so. Yeah, but they are not bright, but when you look hard enough WN stars, you will probably always measure X-rays, yeah?
Earlier classical compact stars always have X-rays. We don't know why they have X-rays. WC stars do not have X-rays, and we think that it's because they're absorbed by wind. But then you go to WO stars, and that's getting interesting because they are so hot, 200,000 effective temperature. So wind is completely ionized. X-rays can go through, and then we see X-rays in WO stars, and these X-rays are very, very hot, hard. I forgot now, 5-7 keV or something like that. It cannot be wind, therefore we're hand waving, no, speculate, say, must be magnetic field. So the spectra are poor. I fit it with synchrotron, but.
It's remarkable we know more Wolf-Rayet stars in the small galaxies like SMC. So in your opinion, would it be worthwhile to, you know, I think the data actually exists to identify the galactic versions, which should be, if there are 1,000 in the SMC, there should be, you know, tens of thousands in the galaxy.
Wolf-Rayet stars?
Yeah.
Now, yeah, 1,000 roughly are known now. And I would say 400 or so are seen in the optical, the rest only in the infrared, which makes...
Right. So I'm saying, would it be worthwhile, in your opinion, to find the remaining, the majority of the Wolf-Rayet stars not yet discovered in the galaxy?
No.
Well, not of course, but with a reason.
What?
Why would it be, I'm asking you, give me some reason. Before work is done, I'd like to understand why we should increase the Wolf, I mean, I have my own ideas, but I want to hear your ideas of increasing the population, the galactic population.
Well, why we would, actually I didn't get the question exactly.
Why would it be interesting to look at the entire population? Would the shape lie on
what? No, yeah, but that has been done all the years, so the population which is not obscured is complete since decades.
Do we need to make full survey to detect all WR stars and if yes, then why?
In our galaxy.
Yep.
In our galaxy.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, now the remaining ones are obscured and they are.
Why you want to have more WR stars?
Yeah, I didn't say that I want.
okay, good. Less work.
Yeah. I find it now more interesting to go extragalactic. Yeah, there are more galaxies of low metallicity which can be resolved. And this is the direction we are going now, because now we have the modern spectrograph like MUSE, integral field spectrography with good spatial resolution that helps.
Okay, thank you.
One last question.
So I'm curious about what you had about this red supergiants not going so bright, because one thing you need for the common envelope evolution channel, for the most massive ones, is to have this extremely bright and big red supergiants. So we're talking about thousands of several thousand solar radii sometimes. Uh-huh. So what are the prospects of doing extragalactic observations to better constrain how big red supergiants can get at lower metallicities?
Okay, so red supergiants, not exactly my business. The plot which I showed, it's data from Phil Massey. He did a survey, of the small Magellanic Cloud, for instance, and of other nearby galaxies. And it is really, it's really a survey, I think, in at least in the field which he covered, it is complete. So there are no such bright red supergiants.
So this pushes, how low metallicity is?
This pushes?
How low in metallicity are you doing that statement?
Now that statement was for small Magellanic Cloud.
Yeah, so I guess, I guess a small Magellanic Cloud is still too metal rich for
could
whatever
be,
anyone
could
predicts.
Be, yeah. You may look, maybe Phil Massey is going into this direction to further galaxies, but no, we should not deprive. So sorry for taking
No problem. Okay, so it's like that.